WPFW.com. And thanks for all you do to nourish and sustain WPFW, building a better world one broadcast at a time.
You'd be so nice to come home to. You'd be so nice. Bye.
Hello, I'm David Whetstone, and you're listening to member-supported WPFW Washington. And welcome to 89.3 FM, WPFW, your Pacifica station emanating from Washington, D.C., 50,000 watts strong, 46 years in its existence due to you, the listener, supporting your Jazz and Justice radio station. I'm your host, David Whetstone. This hour is We the People. Our guest today is Damon Austin, and we're going to talk about a path forward for Black youth. Black youth are growing up in particularly hard times. Adults and settings play formative roles in the forward progress of their lives. Libraries and librarians can positively contribute to their education and personal lives. We'll gain some perspectives and details from our guest. Mr. Austin, welcome. Let me tell the audience that you are a career librarian. You hold a master's degree in library and information sciences from the University of South Carolina, and you've worked professionally and have served as a board member across the gamut of library sectors, whether that's the federal government, whether that's in academia, public and school libraries, and you've been active in the American Library Association, being a member for nearly 20 years. It's last week's conference here in Washington, D.C., of the American Library Association that we met. Currently, you're the director of Library and Media Services at Zamatha Catholic High School in Hinesville, Maryland, not too far from Washington, D.C., for those who are outside the area. And you previously worked as a faculty librarian for the University of Florida and the University of Maryland College Park campus. Additionally, I like to add in, I'm sure it's going to be reflected somewhere in our conversation, you serve as a professional tennis coach who's worked with several top 100 ranked men and women players. Again, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you today.
Thank you, David. Thank you for having me, and it's an honor to be here.
Well, when we met at the American Library Association conference last week, it was no accident that we both almost immediately talked about what Black young people face in today's world. It seems that they're under tremendous pressures and challenges. Those pressures and challenges also represent opportunities, I should say. And as try as they might, for they're not hapless, it is very, very difficult to grow out of youth and into adulthood and to get an educational experience that really does aid in that goal. So I need to understand a couple of things. We're going to try to have a deep appreciation of what you've observed over your years of practice. But what is your perspective on how things are managing, both you being in a school setting and also for your students, for young Black people that you encounter as, again, students?
That's a great question. And before I answer, I think I heard you say, I just wanted to correct something. My master's degree is from the University of South Florida in
South
Tampa.
Florida.
And,
okay.
And if I didn't say that, some people might get on my case. So I just
we'll be in big trouble.
Yeah, we should. So now your question was, again, about what Black students are facing. Can you just restate that one more time for me?
Well, surely. You know, we need to acknowledge that youth have agency. They have creativity, they have identity, and they have their own sense of spirit. And it would be a good thing to find adults in settings that are supportive. We've been through a period of a pandemic, of social and political unrest, and of course, a period of racial reckoning. All that really weighs heavily, existentially and otherwise, upon students. And I was just interested in what you've been observing.
Oh, that's absolutely, I've observed all that. I find that absolutely correct. And I feel that in my library career, it sort of leads me to this point. I started out, as you mentioned, as an academic librarian at universities, working with college students, and then I was also a federal librarian working. And I've come back to the school environment, particularly the high school environment with all boys in a school that is statistically 55% African-American or more. And I feel more at home working with them. I've told them, I've told many of them, it doesn't even feel like work because, and I tell you why, because this is where I want to be. I want to, I recall when I was in high school, I did not have very many Black male teachers. I certainly never saw a Black male librarian. And in order to reconcile the social perceptions of these things sort of affected my ability to envision myself in certain professions. So I just wanted to provide for them along with some of the social comforts that they will need to see someone who hopefully appears to be intelligent, professional, strong person that can model a few of the things that they want, they will need to aspire themselves to. That's what I hope I am doing. But in answer to the other questions, we certainly recognize as teachers and educators how effective the young students have been through the pandemic, for instance. Some of them had a very difficult time maintaining academics, maintaining social connections, and just experiencing themselves. And of course, I think it was hard on all people, but in particular, when we talk about Black boys and what they're dealing with that maybe the larger public may not see as well, I'm particularly sensitive to that. Does that sort of initially answer your question?
Yeah, it does. And again, we're saluting, you know, even though the context is what's trying for young people, we're saluting and honoring them hopefully throughout this entire conversation. Young people are creative, they're resourceful. We see good evidence, particularly through the arts and their learning experience, that they assert themselves, they have agency. But if we can dispel a stereotype, let's entertain for a moment the question I'm going to kind of inadvertently slam mainstream media. In all frankness, do young people, particularly boys, have what it takes to navigate all of this? You must see both success and struggle in what they're doing and how they're trying to live.
No, that's absolutely correct. I witness and celebrate the successes that, and every success I think is important, that I wanted to be in a position where I could, to a person, to a student, tell them and acknowledge their successes. And when I recognize young men in the library that I work, they sometimes you can tell when their shoulders are down a little bit or something to that effect. And I constantly and consistently walk through the library asking gentlemen, if they're young gentlemen, are you okay? How you doing? What's going on in your classes? Just and sometimes I know I'm not going to get you know, an in-depth answer, but what I want them to understand is that I'm always looking at them. I'm always looking out for their best interest and always have a deep interest in them as a person, as well as their education. So they surprise me with their creativity at times. It's very interesting. Some things I don't expect. And that is, I try to celebrate that as well, openly, and try to encourage them to seek some of the deeper things of in their educational experience and encourage their personal journey where they don't have to be perfect. They don't have to be perfect at all. Even in times when I have to address them in maybe a way, in a little bit of a corrective measure, it's always done with a way that is acceptance, is accepting of them. I get the message across that I'm not rejecting them. It may be a part of their behavior, but they have many, many more benefits to who they bring to the school than otherwise.
I wanted to be mindful of something. I mentioned again that you're the director of library and media services at Dematha Catholic High School nearby Washington, D.C. in Hyattsville, Maryland. If you could just tell us a little bit about this setting, like how many students altogether and how many students have you encountered over time?
So I've been the director of the library. We just finished my sixth year. Of course,
congratulations.
Thank you. Of course, one and a half of them was remote through with COVID and that issue. So the school currently has roughly 800, 850 students. And again, it's all boys. And the several classes, freshman through senior, are generally about even numbers, you know, about the average, about same numbers, although that's increasing, which is good news. I have encountered hundreds of students. Obviously, they come through into the library to study before the pandemic. We could obviously get a lot more students in the library during study hall hours and such. And then coming back after COVID, it was a little more sparsely populated. However, just simply hundreds, and we have our regulars. And these are the, obviously, just like any teacher or coach, had the opportunity to impact some students more than others, and some come back rather regularly just to be in the environment, which is a great thing to notice. And so I've enjoyed the opportunity to give advice, sometimes professionally as a librarian, sometimes as a man, what would you do in this situation, these kinds of things. And I think, and I have to commend the administration. They support that type of activity from the faculty as well.
That's fantastic. So given the context that you just told us in your earlier remarks, I wanted to ask an initial question, which we can fill out as we're going along in our conversation. You were saying that you were referencing, alluding, and even entrusting the notion of trust between you and the boys or the young men who you encounter. And you were saying that there's some things that they share. Sometimes it takes time through a relationship to really get a full, robust sense of trust and exchange. But can you just tell me initially, not only through their educational experience, but through their social experience at the school, are their responses collective? I mean, kind of rhetorically, that's obvious, but maybe there's something to understand in that, how they collectively respond to their experience at school.
Well, specifically in the library, their response, their collective response. I have asked some of my colleagues, a couple of my colleagues, and because I think after the first year, I really wasn't certain. And one of my colleagues assured me that, yes, you have some kids who really do appreciate what you're doing. Now, I think how the kids, the young men, how they respond, it varies. Sometimes they do it verbally. Sometimes they come and ask me to watch their wrestling match, or are you going to come watch, you know, my musical performance? Because DeMatha has a very strong musical program. So it comes in a variety of ways. I can tell you this, to the matter of your point of trust. I don't know if this is a manifestation of the pandemic or what have you, but I had a student who I don't have him in any of my classes or any such, but he came to me one day, this is just a couple of months ago, and he asked me, what are you doing after school? And I was a little bit surprised. I'm thinking, what is this about? And he just asked me if I could take a walk around the grounds of the school with him. And I had suspected that he wanted to just share some thoughts or something. Now, something happened where that didn't take place, but I was pleasantly surprised that he thought enough of me that he'd want to share that time. And a second, I'll give you a second. The same year, same school year, after the winter, another student came to me, and at this point, he was a senior, so I hadn't seen him regularly since he was a sophomore due to the pandemic. And I can remember he would come in from the beginning of his freshman year, and he wasn't very loquacious kid and didn't really say much. So if you'd asked me to identify his voice with my back turned, I might not have been able to do it. But he comes up to my window, thinking he needs something, printing assistance or some sort of as such. And I asked him what he needs, and he says, nothing. I just came by to talk. And he proceeds to sit down in my office in front of my desk, and he talks for 15 minutes on what he'd been doing throughout the day and how he felt about the school year. Unsolicited. So this also made me feel like there was a matter of trust and just my presence at some level was useful to them. And that was a very gratifying.
Thank you. I want to remind listeners that you're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. You're listening to us on WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. And like other programmers, our programs that reflect jazz and justice are available on social media platforms like SoundCloud, iTunes, Google Podcasts, and other platforms as well. I want to thank the listeners, particularly getting us through a spring into summer fund drive, which supports this station. We're entirely listener supported. We're with Damon Austin. Mr. Austin is the Director of Library and Information Services at DeMatha Catholic High School. His experience since it's a boys' school, we're talking about a path forward for Black youth, particularly Black boys. And we're going to shift gears a little bit before our additional break. And we've read a monograph that you shared with me earlier. And it's important to say we're referring to boys or young men, but not men or males in particular. And that seems to be a stereotype both in the media and academia circles. And sometimes young Black boys are adultified or criminalized, and that does not need to be the case. They need to be seen as human beings that need a formative experience. Can you expand on that concern that you have?
Yes, well, we have, as we know, we have an issue with Black boys in particular and their peers in terms of literacy. One thing I did when I was when I first came to the library here, and coming from an academic university setting, I kind of wanted to expose the young men to what they might experience at the next level. This is a college prep school, and sometimes I wonder if college prep schools all over the nation, how they're serving Black boys. And so one thing I did is I posted some College Board statistics from the SAT. Now, I know that there's a whole issue with the SAT and maybe bias. However, that being the case, the SAT is still used significantly when it comes to universities and colleges, at least pre-pandemic. So I showed them longitudinal statistics from 1987 to 2016, 15 or 16. And in each of the three categories that were available, in each category for every year, Black students were in last place without variation for that span of years from 1987 to 2015, maybe 2016. Every category, every year, Black students were at the bottom of their peers in every subject. So I just try to use those things, I projected on the screen so that those students who come in, they can see it. And, you know, they're interested. They look at their demographic category, and this is all interesting. So I do that in order to spur their interest, to let them know that, but not only leave them there, but also give them resources, give them concepts, ideas on how their performance in their class immediately is affecting their ability to acquire and then use information to their own advantage, to use their education. As we know, Black people in the United States during the 19th century, they practiced literacy as a formative, transformative activity, not only for individuals, right? But it's a social transformation.
Yeah, for the whole community, for the benefit
of the entire community, right? And that's what's important, I think, for us. As educators, to be able to bridge that gap, that not only the generational gap of communication and our expectations of literacy, but to understand how young people use and understand literacy and the new forms of literacy that are being used in social media and the platform that it holds with them. So this is something I want to address immediately, and I've been doing so in my time here in a variety of ways.
Well, we'll find out about the concept of literacy and what its full robust meaning and implications are for Black boys in there with Damon Austin. He is the director of Library and Information Services at Dematha Catholic High School. And our topic is A Path Forward for Black Youth. It's a particular focus that we have on Black boys. It's not the exclusion of Black girls, but to be mindful of an educational process that benefits them both. A little bit of housekeeping, listeners. We are going to take a brief break for public service announcements and be back with you shortly. Stick with us. We'll be right back after these good words.
The best in live music entertainment is coming this spring to Bethesda Theater. Also coming is Trouble Funk, featuring go-go legend Big Tony, celebrating his birthday by performing all their go-go classics on Friday, May 3rd at 9 p.m. And on Mother's Day, it's Howard Hewitt performing his own popular songs and those by Shalimar, for two shows on Sunday, May 12th at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. The Whisperers on April 26th and 27th, Trouble Funk featuring Big Tony on May 3rd, and Howard Hewitt on Mother's Day, May 12th. Get more information on all shows at BethesdaTheater.com. WPFW is a proud media partner with Bethesda Theater.
And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here at WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org, your jazz and justice radio station, through the Pacifica Radio Foundation, but also because you, the listener, have chosen to give us support both financially and socially for more than 46 years. Today's show is a focus on A Path Forward for Black Youth. We're particularly focusing on Black boys, and our guest is Damon Austin, who is the Director of Library and Media Services at Dematha Catholic High School. So we're talking about the importance of the educational experience, not neglecting that it's a broader social life experience for Black boys and for Black girls as well. The reason why we're addressing the matter of Black boys in particular is because Mr. Austin's experience at Dematha is that it's an all-boys school. So, again, welcome back. Thank you so much for being with us. We were talking and introducing the notions of history and literacy, and it may be a good time to just stop and again reiterate that whether it's in the 19th century or earlier, and certainly well after, Black communities, members thereof, viewed education and literacy and understood and practiced it as a transformative experience, that it was not just for individuals, but it's a collective notion and experience for individuals and communities. And unfortunately, of course, we know that U.S. American history, those efforts were countered by mainstream majority cultures, and yet we must kind of look back on these periods in order to move forward. So what do we mean by literacy, first of all?
Well, that's a great question, because we understand that we've been faced with a framework designed to keep Blacks in a certain state of limited agency. So the literacy certainly addresses agency. We have several different portions of literacy. We have educational written literacy that we're all familiar with. There's also cultural literacy that has come along, I think, in the public sphere since I was in high school more than 30 years ago. And now we have digital literacy, which is something that this young generation is facing. So they're facing all three and have to learn how to reconcile and synthesize all of these in a way that's going to inspire a future that they can be proud of and that they can look forward to. And so we as educators, I think, need to understand these different forms of literacy and sort of package them so that the young, sort of our students and our young men in particular, young Black men very much in particular, can understand how to connect the past and the recent past with what they see as their present and future.
Yes. Trying to grasp that even a little bit more firmly, I alluded to or even briefly mentioned that in preparation for the interview, you were kind enough to share a monograph or a fancy name for an important article that's both scholarly, but also within public access. Two educators, Sakina Everett and Tamara Moten, wrote the following article, Looking Back and Learning Forward, Cultivating Robust Literacy Instruction and Joy Among Black Elementary Boys. So in this article, they talked about not only the importance of history, but starting early with Black boys. Particularly, they worked with a large number of fourth graders. And I'm going to popularize this, but you can correct me if I'm wrong. Most parents and friends of young people view that third and fourth grade period as a big leap period where there's both kind of a humorous defiance, but there's also a cuddliness, and both things eclipse this like sense of wonder and an early kind of form of a right to learn that is manifest in certain behaviors with young boys and young girls. How from that fourth grade period on into high school, how are these experiences showing up? I assume you see both positive things and negative things. What's been going on of recent?
Well, that's a great question. I currently don't work with very young children. Those under the age of 13, probably.
Right. You're talking about kids that are making it to high school, and you're saying
right, right. And so, but I do certainly agree with what I've heard and the experts I've spoken to. When you're talking about the younger ages, that's a critical age to catch them in, to capture their curiosity and continue to spur them on. Now, I can tell you, I served as a reviewer for short stories from students who wrote, again, these short stories for the American Library in Paris. And this is a different group of students. Certainly, I don't know their backgrounds, but some of the popular themes that were coming through, some of the things that young people were exposed to, I can sort of translate that to what young people are looking at today. But in addressing how the Black students that I work with, the young Black men I work with, how they're addressing that, they have a variety of interests. I've noticed a lot of them are into manga, which has again resurged as very popular for them, and Black sci-fi. Some of them have not only interested in science fiction, but they're looking for science fiction written by Black authors or stories that reflect more of their personal experience or characters that could reflect obviously some of their characteristics.
And allow me an outtake. There are people like Stephen Barnes or Octavia Butler, N.K. Jemisin. I'm just trying to think of other people as well. I'm sure I'm overlooking someone. Forgive me. And go ahead. I just often like to give listeners some material, some resources.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely correct. That's wonderful. And this is very important. And there are a number of authors who are on the horizon coming through, pushing in good work. And a lot of them can be found on the YALSA site, you know, book list, et cetera. And so I connect.
And for listeners who don't know, what is the YALSA site?
Oh, yes. The Young Well, y'all
sorry to do that to you.
That's okay, because now I have a block. So
okay, we'll get to it. I'll help you out here.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about the importance of fiction and nonfiction for these mm-hmm. boys.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I've constantly been alluding to this monograph is that these works make up a curriculum, and this curriculum is taught by teachers and, dare I say, librarians as well. I'm of an older generation where sometimes the teacher would take us down to the library or to media services, and we would either have a special lecture or a video or kind of a collective group concentration on mm-hmm. not only text, but the notion of media and ideas and what we're learning. And so there's a particular curriculum that I think you're familiar with. It's called Black Boys College Literacy Institute. And it's that sense of curriculum that you were talking about in defining literacy. Maybe we could just introduce people to some basic notions. I'll start with, so thus far, it should be apparent to listeners that literacy is power. And you librarians, as well as teachers, believe in the engagement with Black boys that they have a capacity to exponentially increase their reading and writing development, their knowledge, and their intellectual and personal growth. So literacy should nurture that. Do I have that quite right? And do you want to say more?
Well, I think you're absolutely correct. And just to very quickly go back to, I had these, as we were just at the American Library Association conference, I've got a lot of these acronyms in my head, but YALSA is the Young Adult Library Services Association. And so, and I work with the American Association of School Librarians, also AASL. So all these A's and got me a little off. But no, you're absolutely correct. What literacy needs to affect also is supporting cultural roles, gives cultural affirmation to young students, and make real them, if it makes sense, themselves to themselves, sort of affirm what they see in literature. And this is not news. This has been talked about and supported for a long time, and even in the educational sphere, in the library sphere. Additionally, librarians need to be included in the school curriculum development. And that is one of the large points of the AASL, and one of the standards that we go by when we're trying to certainly affect and determine what type of materials students are exposed to, and how we can direct their growth as young adults. And this is very important, because I can tell you it although students may respond to videos and movies, sometimes you need, well, always you actually need the written word, if it's a biographical, autobiographical, not simply just the movie of an autobiography of some popular historical figure. Yeah.
I'm glad you're mentioning these points. For one thing, we want to move away from the larger stream of trying to achieve academic and to some degree social success by teaching toward tests that are standardized, that don't reflect or do respect the dignity to Black boys and Black students. And we want to really understand that there's a strong historical and social context that when Black people committed to learning to read, write, and speak, they're accumulating a very special sense of knowledge and skills and motivation to further shape, define, and navigate their own lives. I cannot state that enough, and hopefully we'll strategically reiterate that throughout our interview. But an important thing that leaps out, and Black scholars who dedicate their selves to pedagogy, a fanciful term for teaching, emphasize the notion of joy, that there should be an experience of joy in this. Can you explain that, please?
Yes, I can. That's a great point. I can give it to you in a very recent event. I was teaching a course, and there was a young man. The course was had to do with, it was a Black American Black literature, right? And so I supplied a number of sources that one young man hadn't been exposed to, and he, you could just see his eyes light up in terms of, I didn't know this. I didn't know we could access this type of information. And some of it was historical. A lot of it had to do with what I tried to do was weave, in this particular instance, hip hop music to some of the history and some of the themes that we see recurrent in American history. And then link it to the generations of hip hop into what they are, the music that they have in hip hop rap today. So to acknowledge their experience and see how they're connected to me and how we are connected to a greater history and a greater understanding of who we are. And this is, yes, this is certainly Black boys, but also at the human level, this is also something I'm trying to do with all of the students. So I want to encourage their understanding of the content of what they're studying, make it relevant, make it real, and engage, and they become active. So we don't have to say we're going to engage them in active learning. They're going to become active, and they're going to become the drivers and take us in directions that we already understand. And we end up bringing them back to the great point, right? Relating the new information to prior knowledge. And so that they have a greater understanding of culture, content, and connectivity to the world that they're experiencing.
I'm glad you're mentioning this last point. One, just by way of confirmation, for older folk, sometimes commercial rap or hip hop really denies them an access of understanding of how positive it is. So I want to deliberately lift up a positive example. The rapper No Name, she comes out of the Bronzeville section of Chicago. She's in her 30s. And she's put together literacy reading groups, and it's not uncommon for you to find these groups meeting. And this is going to bring us to an important point that I hope we mention before we leave, that there's the school setting, there's the library setting, but there are also other modalities, locations, settings, and other adults that can reinforce this experience of literacy, because No Name, again, has vigorously sponsored and encouraged and supported these reading groups. They're associated with libraries, with different civic associations. A shout out to Mahogany Books and Sankofa Books and Video here in Washington, D.C. for supporting such activities. And it's, again, pointing to a different kind of utility in one's educational experience. And you said earlier, too, I hope we're continuing to hammer the sense of the collective. We want our students to collaborate around text. In other words, what is meaningful and significant in their own thoughts, but also in exchanges with each other that help initiate and shape decisions for their well-being?
Yeah, so certainly... building in critical thinking and meaningful learning exercises. And again, if you want to discuss some activities that are beyond the classroom, I always ask students, what clubs are you active in? Are you active in any clubs? Not only sports, but are you active in any clubs? Even if they're athletes, they do commit a lot of time to that. And I encourage them to go into particular clubs that might have their interest. It could be anything, because any of the clubs, for it could be cybersecurity, it could be Black Student Association, these types of things.
You mentioned the tech interest earlier.
Yeah. Right, exactly, right. And yes, And because I had some students who certainly expressed an interest in that. And I'm glad you brought that up, because that informs their digital literacy, because they are constantly find themselves in the digital environment. And I mentioned earlier three types of literacy: educational written literacy, cultural literacy, digital literacy. But when I was in high school, more than 30 years ago, people weren't even talking about cultural literacy, at least not to my memory. And certainly, we didn't have cell phones and or PCs, you know, home computers very much at all. So our young people are dealing with several parts of the literacy question that we hadn't even had to consider. And we had to just keep ourselves from being distracted. Whereas in this environment, the distractions are coming at them nonstop. And there's, as we understand, more than a $6 billion industry to keep young people distracted and their faces in their phones. And so addressing that, and that issue is not going away. So we as educators need to find ways to reroute some of the positives of the environment and of the platforms that they're using to get them to be able to relate, synthesize new information to prior knowledge, and then formulate a future that is going to be positive for them.
And we'll talk about one option or one way or one method to do that, but allow me to reintroduce you. We're talking to Damon Austin. Mr. Austin is the Director of Library and Media Services at Zamatha Catholic High School. And we're talking about a path forward for Black youth, in particular Black boys. But I hope listeners really hear with sensitivity that directed concerns are for both Black boys and for Black girls. And we're talking about Black boys in particular, considering that Zamatha is an all-boys school. But I hope, again, that you find applicability to many of the things we're talking about for all of our young people and for the benefit of all our communities. You're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM. As I said before, this hour is We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. You can listen to us also on WPFWFM.org. We're here over 46 years bringing you jazz and justice, but programming like at 1 p.m. on our through the airways broadcast of Africa Now, stories and context and history and culture of people not only of the African continent, but throughout the diaspora, hosted by Moesa Mutale again on Wednesdays, 1 p.m. Eastern. It's programming like that that you, the listener, have supported for 46 years. I, for one, heartily thank you, along with my fellow programmers and staff here at WPFW. Mr. Austin, I can't thank you enough for being with us. I wanted to give listeners yet another tool or something to look up that will encourage them, not only in school settings, and with all due respect, not only in libraries, which is a good place to be, by the way, and a shout out to all the librarians in the area and again to the American Library Association. But here's the tool: multidimensional reading models, sometimes known as MDRMs, multidimensional reading models. And these models are modules that are usually 60 minutes, not limited to that, but it's a way of teachers to engage students daily. One particular appeal is, as you were alluding to earlier, is that they cover a whole range of subjects and disciplines. And in the context of Black teachers, I need to say there's been a history of doing a very good job of integrating across disciplines. So for instance, a science example may not be just solely in the limited realm of science properly understood, but it may involve economics. It may involve the student's personal community experience. Can you say more as to the effectiveness of these models?
Well, yes, I think that's a wonderful point. And I think it's important to show, to demonstrate to students how what they're studying is related to the variety of disciplines that they experience in the world around them. I often try to, when I'm giving a class, I try to bring up one example in one area, and then I'll expand it to a broader concept. For instance, when talking about authority, finding authoritative sources and research, I might say, the other day I was watching ESPN or something to that effect, and one of the anchors was talking about an athlete, something had happened, and it was rather an opinion. And then in behind them in the background, there's a tweet that pops up from just some person who may or may not be an expert. There's no credential given to the person. It's just the tweet itself supports what that anchor at that moment is saying. And I get them to understand, I ask them, is this authority? Like, how do we know this person is authoritative? And they're living in a world where if in digital platforms, particularly, if everyone has authorship, then everyone at some level has a degree of authority. So how do we get them to wade through that? Because it does touch every aspect. It touches our science and technology. It touches our entertainment, et cetera. So I try to get them to think broadly across these platforms and these experiences to then be able to judge how does A relate to B. Yes. So that's what I try to get them to do.
We need to capitalize on this last point. Mm-hmm. You know, we've been talking about creating a safe space, an affirming space. And so what you're talking about really empowers your students to understand what's an empowering text, what's an empowering process, what's a disenfranchising or a disempowering text. And it comes by way of teachers and librarians that they begin to understand, dare I say it, that they're loved, that they're respected, that the time spent with each other is worthwhile, and that is their right to have a particular keen sense of joy in their learning experience. So with all that being said, the joy they express is the driver of their own interest, and their lives are expansive. So, you know, we can, pardon the wrongful generalization, but we can be old school and hopefully properly through love emphasize things like executive functions, like the power of rhetoric, that you read, you write, you speak, and all three things are terribly important to your own personhood, to your own humanity. So I will leave you with this last question and with a few minutes to spare. You've seen a lot. We definitely have mentioned positive examples throughout the hour. What are you hopeful for with the young boys you encounter for youth in the near future? What would you like to see that would be different or even better for them?
Well, I'm hopeful to answer the first part, because young people, they come out the way they come out. Like all children are born as they're born. They only respond to their environment. So I'm hopeful that we can continue to create an environment where they get to express, by the time they're in high school, they get to express with self-affirming words, self-affirming concepts, and proudly get to express their thoughts, their feelings. I'd like to see an environment that encourages that more readily and openly through all the facets of the environment that they engage in, school, sports. I'm a sports coach as well, so I understand how we can have young people, how we can encourage them in that manner, as well as the educational side of things as well. Giving them a little bit, much more mentorship and some things that we think they may already know. I'm a little bit surprised that sometimes we as adults and educators think that, oh, these kids know this, they're 14, 15, but they may not actually know that. And I think in particular, after the pandemic, we are dealing with a different bag of conditions that no one could predict, and it's even harder on them. So I'm hopeful that that can be done. I'd like to see a little bit more of it. And I'm actually hopeful that it will be done through programs like this that continue to inform the public.
Thank you, Damon Austin. All the best to you and your efforts. You have truly presented a path forward for Black youth.
Thank you for having me.
All right. And you're greatly appreciated. Again, thank you for spending the hour with us. Coming up next, right after our closing, will be the news, usually from Sue Goodwin from our News and Public Affairs Department that I thank. I thank Mike Nasella, our engineer. And every noontime during the week, don't forget the Blues, the Wednesday edition with Clarence the Blues Man Turner. Listeners, I want to again thank you for supporting this show, but in particular, WPFW. We need you. We appreciate you. Let's keep going strong. Thank you again, and hopefully we'll meet again at this hour. Take care.
Hi, this is Robin Holden.
Hi, this is Miyuki Williams.
WPFW programmers Miyuki Williams, Robin Holden, Craig Williams, Jim Byers, Verna Avery Brown, James Funk, Captain Fly, Tom Cole, Bill Wax, Kim Bay, Millie Ware, Joni Eisenberg, Arthur McLeod, Donald Temple, Bill Starr, Lona Elias, Ron Pinchback, David Whetstone, DJ Abby, DJ Divine, and Willard Jenkins will celebrate you at Washington's premier jazz club, Tacoma Station, 6914 4th Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. This is a musical tribute on Sunday, May 26, from 5 until 9 p.m.
This event features internationally renowned bassist Michael Bowie, Hope Udobie on keyboards, Charles Wilson drums, Grace J and Sing Steph on vocals, and others.
Please come and join your favorite programmers for some great jazz, food, cocktails, and a little dancing for a Sunday jazz happy hour you will never forget.
The event happens at the Tacoma Station Jazz Club, 6914 4th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., a musical fundraising tribute, Sunday, May 26, 5 until 9 p.m. The tickets are $50, and there are only 100 tickets for this VIP event. Secure your tickets to the jazz happy hour.
Tickets are available at Eventbrite. When in Eventbrite, please search WPFW Tacoma Station. We're looking forward to celebrating you on Sunday, May 26th from 5 until 9 p.m. at Tacoma Station.
The best in live music entertainment is coming this spring to Bethesda Theater. Also coming is Trouble Funk, featuring go-go legend Big Tony, celebrating his birthday by performing all their go-go classics on Friday, May 3rd at 9 p.m. And on Mother's Day, it's Howard Hewitt performing his own popular songs and those by Shalimar, for two shows on Sunday, May 12th at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. Trouble Funk, featuring Big Tony on May 3rd, and Howard Hewitt on Mother's Day, May 12th. Get more information on all shows at BethesdaTheater.com. WPFW is a proud media partner with Bethesda Theater.
WPFW is looking for a new place to hang our hats and microphones. And we're betting that members of WPFW's In the Know listening community, folks like you, may know of spaces where we might make our new home. Have you walked past or know of a cool space that appears to be for lease? Hit us to it. Know of something that's not yet on the market? We're all ears. Your station for jazz and justice requires 2,200 square feet of space in Washington, D.C. or immediate environs. Metro accessible with nearby parking. We value your suggestions and observations as we embark on this vital mission. Email your tips to wpfw.lsb.relocation@gmail.com. And thanks for all you do to nourish and sustain WPFW, building a better world one broadcast at a time.
You'd be so nice.
From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today's Wednesday, May 1st. Here are some headlines. Confrontations between law enforcement and protesters against Israel's war effort in Gaza continue at universities across the United States. Today, police arrested protesters and dismantled tents on the University of Wisconsin campus in Madison, Wisconsin, to break up an encampment in support of Palestinians. At the University of Arizona, the police department said officers sprayed chemical irritant munitions to disperse protesters early this morning. And at a press conference this morning, New York Mayor Eric Adams said nearly 300 people were arrested at Columbia University and City College last night. This came after early yesterday morning, protesters on the Columbia campus occupied an academic building, barricading entrances. Riot police overnight used a truck modified with a ladder to climb to a second-story window. Police then cleared the protesters from the building and removed the remains of a tent encampment. Columbia has requested that New York cops remain on the campus until May 17th. According to AP, more than 1,000 people have been arrested in 10 days of U.S. campus protests. A central demand of many protests is that the universities divest their funds from Israel-linked companies and support a ceasefire in Gaza. In response to those demands, a deal was reached yesterday between Brown University and the Brown Divest Coalition. Protesters involved with the coalition agreed to remove all tents and end the encampment on campus in exchange for a promise from the university to hold a board vote in October on whether or not to divest from Israel-linked companies. In a statement, Brown President Christina Paxson said that student protesters will not be suspended or expelled for their conduct, and that students agreed to, quote, refrain from further actions that would violate Brown's conduct code through the end of the academic year, close quote. In other news, the Arizona Senate is expected to vote as soon as today on a measure to repeal the state's 1864 ban on all abortions except for those necessary to save the life of the mother. The ban was revived by a state Supreme Court ruling in early April, which led to a vote for repeal in the Arizona House last week. A repeal now appears to have enough support to pass in the state Senate, even with Republicans holding a slim majority. If passed, the measure could immediately be sent to Governor Katie Hobbs, a Democrat, who has said she will sign it. And starting today, people can no longer access legal abortions in Florida beyond 6 weeks of pregnancy, except in rare circumstances. The restriction replaces a 15-week ban that's been in effect since July 2022 and is one of the strictest in the nation. Opponents of the ban stress that many people don't even realize they are pregnant at 6 weeks. Voters will have a say on the matter in November when a proposal to enshrine abortion rights into the state constitution will appear on the election ballot. The proposed amendment would allow abortions before viability or up to 24 weeks and would need more than 60% support to pass. And in weather today in Washington, D.C., it is 78 degrees and sunny. Temperatures are 4